Today, I'm going to talk about the masters, and then we'll close the convention. But I thought that I would ask the beautiful singers last night, and I would like you all to stand, to sing Aum again, and for us to think at the same time, to think and send thoughts of peace to the world at war. So I'm going to ask them.
We would like for everyone to join hands wherever you're next to. And when you sing your A, bring it from the heart. Let the ah or O come from your throat chakra. Grit your teeth on the hymn and let it just vibrate up out through the crown chakra. Together. A deep breath.
This morning, I would like to talk about the masters. I'm fortunate enough, I think, to have been born in a theosophical family. So, from very early in childhood, the idea of the masters there a reality to me. I had a very strange family. I've said this before. Because my mother never cared what I ate. But she thought always the most important thing in life was that we start meditating. And so the one thing she required of all of us children is at the age of 5 on, she took us, we had a special meditation room, and we meditated every morning of our life. So this is a very different upbringing than, I think, from most of you. So thus the idea and of the background of the masters has been a reality to me all of my life. Now, I think in the Theosophical Society, which the founders started, what they believed was on the orders of these beings whom we call the masters of the wisdom, they sacrificed a great deal of their life because finally it wasn't easy to bring about the birth of the Theosophical Society in a world which was dominant by colonialism and also was based on a very materialistic science. Thus, the Theosophical Society, and particularly the founders, who were very firmly grounded on this idea of the masters, did this against a lot of hardship, which I think very few of us realize how difficult it was for them to achieve. The society is now, I believe, about 106 years old. Am I correct? In the 7, is that it? 107 years old. And so I think it has stood a long time in difficult situations. The idea of the masters and is not obligatory for members of the Theosophical Society to accept. The society is a very unique one because one can join really having to accept, I think, the truth of universal brotherhood, and to make universal brotherhood a reality, the study of comparative religion, and thirdly, the unexplained laws of nature. But the idea of the masters, nobody is asked to accept when they join the society. And yet, in the early days, and all through my childhood, because I was myself brought up in a colonial empire, because I was born in Java, the Dutch East Indies, and I was very fortunate in many ways, because it happens to be a strange country where the religion officially is Islam. So the first sounds, religious sounds, I personally ever heard was the Quran. Secondly, it is a mixture of different religions because the Mahabharata, the whole of that story and the Gita, is also indigenous to its culture. So I think I've been brought up in basically the theosophical point of view, but also this mixtures of all ways, of all religions and all cultures. And as I said, my parents were theosophists, and of course, mostly they tried, the dominant power in one way was Christian. But my father, being a theosophist, lectured everywhere on Islam, not on Christianity, and the inner meaning of Islam. And also, we had everybody of all races to our dinner table. So we really broke, and I think most people in those early days had this tremendous feeling that they were serving the masters by really, under very difficult circumstances, bringing the idea of brotherhood in reality. Am I making that clear? And I think we, in later days, we don't realize that the Theosophical Society, and I feel it has done a very great deal in its early days particularly, to break down all racial prejudice and to really serve for this one unity, in other words. I think Arya was the first place in India where all races met together, and besides meeting together, lived together. And that is the important part, that they lived together. And I think, therefore, in the early days, I think people had a far greater sense that they were pioneers. And this sense of that they were pioneers, they were breaking tradition all around them, particularly in East Asia, I think made the members feel much closer to the idea that the masters were a reality. There was very little, except by the Theosophical Society, done on the subject of comparative religion. Remember, now there are hundreds of translations of every known book and every known religion on the market. But remember, in those early days, there was practically nothing. It's hard to remember, isn't it? The HPB, who was certainly a most unique human being, she was unique in many, many, many ways. And she also was really not at any time physically well. She had Bright's disease. She was very ill most of her life. She was a very temperamental human being, but she had this tremendous devotion of bringing to the Western world this idea of what we call, what's in the secret doctrine, and the ancient wisdom. And I, who do not like to write anything by hand, and whose handwriting nobody can read, I always admire her extravagantly, because I cannot imagine anybody doing it, to write out the secret doctrine by hand. And not once, but she made so many corrections that she probably wrote this by hand 2 or 3 times. And if you are not well, and very often she was near death, I think this is an incredible achievement. And she did this, I think. And remember, the masters always said she was the best instrument available. I think this was a very remarkable achievement. And Colonel Olcott, whom I never knew HPB, and I never knew Colonel Olcott. But Fritz, my husband, knew Colonel Olcott. He, of course, was a remarkable American, and he was a lawyer, he and HPB, and this is always very interesting, did not always agree. But they worked nevertheless very closely. And what I think he could be very proud, not only that he was the first president of the Theosophical Society, but that in Southeast Asia, so many, many years ago, he's today still considered a saint. He did a unique something for Buddhism. He, with a dominant Christian civilization, I think that the Colonel started the first Buddhist college and schools, and he brought Buddhism. He made the Buddhists proud of their religion, and he traveled from Japan and everywhere, trying to make the Buddhists from different sects realize what was the central theme of Buddhism they all would agree on. And so he wrote this little book, The Buddhist Catechism, which is still in print. I want to bring this out because I think the newer members of the Theosophical Society really do not realize fully the devotion our founders and our early members had. And I think they were motivated by the reality of the masters. And after 107 years, the Theosophical Society is still alive. Remember that. Now, the masters, I don't think that in today's society there is so much talk about the masters. I want to recommend, of course, the three little booklets by C.J. Jinnaradasa about the masters, the letters, the Mahatma letters, and I think Virginia Hansom did a very nice book. Now tell me the name of it. The Master's Amen, which I think makes it very much easier to understand the circumstances of the Mahatma letters. And all these are, of course, available. The Mahatma letters give one a sense of what the masters are like. They are extraordinary, difficult to understand. The first three books are very much easier to understand, and I would recommend that you would read them first. I think what we think of the masters is we build up a glorified image in our mind of all the virtues which we are conditioned by our background, by our religion, to think what a perfect human being should be. But it's our own conditioning. It's our own mind which makes up a picture. It may not be based so much on the idea of reality. I think this is true, wouldn't it? Like, now, from my point of view, and I'm only going to talk about my personal point of view, as I said, I've been thinking about that all my life, and I'll talk about what I feel and what I feel is true. The masters are here, and they are interested in humanity. If the masters are interested in humanity, they, of course, are interested in the past, but they also have to have a primary interest in the future. I think we always think of the masters in relation to the past. I don't think that we fully, in our imaging of them, think that their force, that their energies are devoted to the present, but also to the future. And therefore, if you read some of those letters, just give, I think, an indication of their personalities. We feel that when we meet a person, that the best way is to have a glossified picture of the person in their mind. That's a word I just made up. But I think it's expressive, isn't it? But by that I mean is, we don't see the person as they are, with all the negative, but we also don't realize the tremendous human potential there is in human beings, with whatever negative qualities there are. There is this tremendous potential, finally, with that. And so, if you read these letters, what comes out of them, that sometimes of a shock, is the blunt language the masters use when they talk about different people. But if you think that they have wisdom, mustn't they see people as they are? This is what I want to say. Let me say this. They called a Mr. Hume many names. They didn't really approve of them. And I'm not sure that he for very long believed in them. But they answered their questions. But let me say another thing is, Mr. Hume, far in the future, became very important in the national freedom movement in India. And the masters always believed that India should be a free country. Thus, they continued seeing what he was at that moment. Again, I'm always saying, in all my dealings with human beings, I always say, at this moment. I think it's a very important thing when we deal with one another to say, at this moment. Because, therefore, you might say they answered letters, they did, at no time did they not see for what he is. But I feel, and this is the point I want to make in my talk, they also were aware of the future. And thus they were helping to build up something in a person who was going to work for that ideal of the freedom of India and the future. And I think this is a point the Mahatma letters have some very interesting insights about the future. And they're not conditioned by our kind of thinking. I think what I find about them so interesting is always the glimpses of what they think about the future. Now, I believe this is an important part we should keep in our mind when we think of them and when we think of the Theosophical Society. That's what I always like to think of. I'm very interested in the Theosophical Society today, but I'm trying to always get a glimpse of the future in that, because it is so very, very easy to be conditioned by the past and say, this is the only way, isn't it? Things have to be constantly changing, but the truths, the eternal doctrine, which the Master stressed, are eternal, the values, aren't they? Now, what HPB and so much, particularly in the voice of the psalm, but even in the letters and the Master's talk about poor, suffering humanity. And it's amazing, after all these years, how it's still poor, suffering humanity, isn't it? I mean, we are at a crucial point, I think, in the history of humanity today. And thus, the Master stressed, and I think we forget that sometimes, not only the individual, but that the Theosophical Society should be an instrument for poor, suffering humanity. It's their phrase, not mine. And they felt that if people and members of the Theosophical Society could understand something about the philosophy they wish to bring into the world, this would be one way of helping that humanity, which was, they was kind of lost in darkness. And of course, when the society was founded, it was worse. I don't know if it was worse, but I think some things, the society, the idea of brotherhood, the idea of respect of all religions, the Theosophical Society has had a hand in bringing about. And in that way, the world is much better, I feel. I do feel very much that has happened, because it is a totally different world. Many, many people are open to these broad ideas. And I still think, therefore, the Theosophical Society, if we could do more work, not only in not being so strict, how can I put it? This I'm giving you a wrong idea of what I mean. From my point of view, theosophy has a very broad philosophical background. And it has so many implications for helping people in many, many different ways. And therefore, I, in my own life, have found that it is possible to reach many different segments which straight theosophical lectures do not reach. It is, I think we have felt that experience in these conventions. But I'm always very deeply touched. I do have workshop for the medical personnel. And what is very lovely, we always have it out with nature. I mean, that's my particular liking. But if you get a lot of people, 100 people together, to whom it's all very strange, if they can hug trees, and if they get a sense of human, of unity with nature and a dedication to that sense of unity, I think this reverence for life, this sense of unity, and also they get the sense that by these concepts they can help others, because this is, of course, the dominant note of all our workshops, is how one dominant idea, besides the use of all these forces, is how can we and help suffering people. And of course we have the suffering people in front of us. It builds, I think, a tremendous sense of unity, a tremendous sense of dedication. And I think, again, I think somebody brought it out, that meditating together is one strong way of building that sense of unity. Because we talk a great deal about using these forces, but we are not aware of what a powerful instrument they are for brotherhood. Can I say that? I have often felt, I mean, I talk to my groups about it, my medical groups. It isn't the talking which is important. Very often we have to do it. It's the ability to give. To give our goodwill, like when we thought about the cancer children today, as I asked all of you to do this morning's meditation, we were sending out our thoughts of healing to those poor children who are here. But I think I've suggested that to the lodges, they should, every lodge, I think, or study center, should think of themselves as a center of peace and try to radiate. This is what we do at Olcott every day, to be a center of peace to that world which is full of anxiety today. The world is full of tremendous anxiety. I think we can do, every one of us, every lodge, every study center can, in other words, do something together. And I personally think if the lodges and study centers could feel that they would be much closer to being centers of theosophy, or because we are not doing it for our own growth. We are doing it, you cannot grow till you have, this is the one thing I say to my groups, till you have learned to achieve some of that peace within ourselves. This is very basic. We each within us have to be a center of peace, haven't we? Thus, when we come back to the masters, I personally believe that they are still a great center of power, and they are still interested in humanity. They always will be. But I believe that the Theosophical Society will continue to grow if we keep in mind not what our individual interests are. But if we could think each center, each lodge, that way it should be a center for both study, but more than that. It's really a dedication to that center of peace, so that when anybody comes into the society, wherever it is, if they enter even your hall, that they are still for a moment and can say, what a wonderful peace feeling I have. There is a feeling of where I can be myself at the highest level. Am I making that clear? And we can. This takes, I think, a dedication. It's not easy to achieve. I think it is very helpful to think about the masters. I think it takes the word which is not easy to come by, but that's the only word which will make the Theosophical Society be a more powerful instrument than it is. And that is a commitment of the individual and a commitment of the group. It really takes it, but it must include a great broadness. The future is changing. That's obvious what I'm saying. We must give with that, go with the masters, go with, in love with whatever it comes, and still hold that the individual is not as important as the group spirit and the working together. I feel that very, very strongly, because so many centers, so many lodges are bogged down on opinion, aren't they, sometimes. You don't have enough the spirit of giving. And I think this is when you study the masters, and if you meditate upon the masters. I'm going to say one more thing about myself. As I said, my mother had this focus, and I was brought, and my upbringing has been totally crazy, but that's all right. But when I was very young, I think I was about 11, and I didn't speak much English, some. I was in correspondence with Sylvia Leadbeater and Bishop Leadbeater, and also with Mrs. Besant. I've got some letters when I was a very little girl, because I knew both of them, Mrs. Besant and Mr. Leadbeater. And we got a letter and a cable that he would like me to come to Australia, because he had got very sick, and there were only boys there and no girls. But at that time, when he was very sick, Mrs. Besant had sent a lady doctor, Dr. Rock, there. So he asked me, would I like to come there, because there was a lady doctor, as I was the only girl. So I was very, very, very shy, because Sylvia L. used to tease me terribly about it all my life. And my parents, remember one thing about my parents. I'm the only girl in a whole family of boys. They said, Dora, it's none of our business. You go to the meditation room and it is completely in your hands. That's kind of a hard thing to do, isn't it? But they absolutely believed that with that meditation, etc., you know, that the decision was up to me. So I did. I went to that meditation room and I decided I would go. And they made it, and I must say, I admire them very much for letting me go all by myself. And so I went to Australia. But I think what I'm saying again here, and the thing I did learn, therefore, very early in life, and I'm going to talk about that in a different fashion, that I should never make major decisions in a hurry because my emotions made me decide something like that. But I learned very early in life that to go back wherever you are in a meditation. In other words, through your meditation, I think one gets a unity between all ourselves, which we have been talking. And if we can reach that, and if you feel, then the decision isn't really based on a personal decision. Am I making that clear? Even when I was so young, and I've always believed that all my life. Now about the masters. I think from my thinking, from my being, I mean, I've seen both Sri Leadbeater and Mrs. Besant through very many stormy periods in their life. And could I say one thing about Mrs. Besant? Because very few people believe this. She was littler than me. But she was much bigger. I mean, not only bigger spiritually, but I mean that way, bigger than me. But I think I've seen her act in very many difficult times. And I think, I always think of her qualities, because she was finally a great leader and a great orator, was that she was so absolutely quiet. You would never think, when I say this, you wouldn't associate that with her, would you? She's always in people's mind, the fiery leader. But it is that stillness, that quietness, which she exhibited, and also, and this, with her oratory, etc., and her tremendous driving power, she had a great compassion, a very great compassion. And through that compassion, I think she had the lifelong devotion from everybody, because it was combined with that sense of power. I think I should say something about Sri Albert, but I find it difficult because he was a mid-Victorian gentleman and far ahead of his time. And this is a contradiction, isn't it? Where Mrs. Besant was so heart and soul in politics, and all this because she started on the left wing finally in her life, Sibley L. had no interest in politics. And he voted to conserve. He thought it was his duty to vote. He never looked at the papers, and he voted the conservative ticket. As he had absolutely, I don't think he ever read the newspaper practically on anything, and I don't know if he thought there were any other parties or not. I mean, there, it's difficult. Not that I could call his mid-Victorian quality, what wouldn't it? Loyalty to the king or the queen, because after all, he was very British in that way. But in other way, he was far ahead of his time. Fantastically, and I'll just tell you one story because I don't want to keep you. My crazy education. When I first went there I'll say, he certainly wasn't conventional in any way. We, all of us, wore no stockings, no shoes, and even in winter, I was the only girl. And you don't know how many people came up to me and offered to buy me shoes. They thought here was a bereft orphan, and that they offered to buy me shoes. Well, I think I learned a great deal. I feel it has been a very good lesson. Afterwards, they all wore shoes and stockings, but I was in the period when they didn't. And I think I'm very glad of that for one reason. I don't care about a lot of things. I think it was a very good lesson to be able to have people look at you and that sort of thing and be completely indifferent to it. I mean, I think, I'm not saying that, I think I'm moderately conservative, but I think it was a very great lesson to do that, and very early in life. Beside that, and then I'm not going to talk about them anymore. I think in both Mrs. Besant and Sybil Leadbeater, I'm coming back to the masters now, there was a complete devotion to the masters. I've seen Sybil Leadbeater. He was very ill for a long time. He did things, but it was absolute agony, physical agony for him to go through it, because he felt this was in the service of the masters, in other words. And thus, one did learn that whatever one felt physically, you know what I mean, to do this if you felt this was in the master's service. I've seen him do, for him at that moment, incredibly painful things. Wouldn't be to you and me as long as we are healthy. And so I think I learned the idea of self-discipline, and that within one there is a tremendous regenerative force, in other words, if one knows how to touch it without thinking of self. And I think all Mrs. Besant, all those people who had that tremendous devotion and did so much worse under adverse conditions, this was the tremendous lesson I personally have learned. About the masters, I would like to give you my impression. Let me say that the Master Moria, as you all are members of the society, you've probably read something about him. He is an Indian and he's a Rajput, and I think he's very tall, very dark. And I think always of the master, and this is a very, very strange word I'm going to use, of someone who has absolute integrity. That's a strange word to use, isn't it? In other words, but what I mean by integrity, and somebody who is always and at all times together. And therefore, I feel also that he is, that he has a regal bearing and has that sense of being every inch a king, but also a tremendous strength. I think if you read the master's letters, you feel and you realize that if he can say something in 10 words instead of 30, he would use the 10 words. It is very compact, very beautiful language, very much to the point. And I think, if you think of Mrs. Besant, of HPB, they had that tremendous sense of direction, in other words, that complete commitment to the Master Moria, who was very specially their master, to do the right thing, because they were doing this for the master's work and that nothing else mattered. I mean, Mrs. Besant was at the height of her fame when what she had done about India, but she felt very strongly that India should be part of the Commonwealth of Nations. And so when she was up in the heights, she decided that she would still stick to that principle. And she lost that from the India, a lot of that tremendous esteem. But she felt this was the right thing to do. And all her life. Now, so I would think this about thinking about the master. I would think about the Master Moria. And you think of yourself in the master's aura. You can imagine that. Not think of the master coming to you. There's a difference. And in other words, if you are really still, what your direction is, if you just keep your mind still and have that devotion, I think you would get the strength and the sense of direction. About the Master K.H., he's fair, he's not so tall. And I think about the Master K.H., if any one of us felt that we wanted to be in his presence, we would probably feel like small miserable worms, isn't that so? If we knew it. I think that he is in the presence of perfect love, because you would forget yourself. And you could therefore feel yourself, and that there was perfect comprehension. All the masters have this. But I think this is the predominant feeling of the Master K.H. His language is beautiful. He's much more understandable. He understands our Western thinking a great deal more. But there is this calmness, this tremendous sense of reaching out. And with this complete understanding, the negative and the positive, which is in all of us. It is so. And I always think they, both the masters, thinking of the future, have always are geared towards right being and right action. If you can think of the master when you are very intolerant, when we feel that we are very right, we have still to right for right action. But if we could think of the master and say, put yourself in that state of mind and see how that would alter your thinking if you are committed to the work of the Theosophical Society. I think that tremendous flow of love and great wisdom which goes in that presence. And I always feel, if we think of the masters in this way, and instead of all, I think we learn a great deal in the letters, but we don't get that sense of personality. Even if you read through the Mahatma letters, you should get at least that they all have a great sense of humor. They have that. I mean, this brings it out. Their great sense of humor. I'm talking about this way because I think it's important for us sometimes to have a glimpse of something real outside of a book. And I believe that studying, therefore, something about the masters and feeling as the masters have no reality for most members of the Theosophical Society in little outlying districts and different places. They don't study it very much. I think this sense of that they are beings that as long, and here I wish to point again this one thing I feel very strongly. It is not for ourselves. It is not like some of the books today. It's nice to have tea with the masters. I don't think they have time. They have that one great mess of humanity. And I think in whatever way we can, if individual members, lodges, study centers are really keeping this in the background of their mind and not what you feel Monday or Tuesday, as you forget the spiritual growth, on my point of view, depends upon the hard thing. You grow because you choose from moment to moment. And spiritual growth depends upon the right choice, doesn't it? I mean, the whole of our lives, the masters, all of them, isn't a sense of dictation by somebody else. It is for us, by our inner meditation, to our commitment to the great thing, to work for that and to work for that. And therefore, I think if the lodges and the study centers could feel that to belong to the Theosophical Society, to study and to share, but to sense this, if you could convey it back again, this real sense, which I feel at least, and I know for myself, this is I wish to say, I know that the masters are real, that the masters are there. But we have to find out this by ourselves, by dedicating ourselves to, by understanding, if you teach theosophy, we have to know what theosophy is. But we also have to have that commitment to humanity, and there is no time, I feel, where that's more needed. And I think that is the way for the future. It is the way to make the masters not an abstraction, but a reality. And I think if that could happen, we forget our personality. The Theosophical Society could be a much more powerful instrument than it is today. It is in unity, it's in harmony and dedication to the masters. Thank you.